It is 8:31. We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
And your long list of places you work at this week just got a notch shorter.
Yeah, it did. And it was actually the place that pays me the most of any of those long places they work at. I certainly don't get a lot from KEXP, for example. No, nothing really. But, except the, you know, the fame and the glory.
Exactly.
As people may have seen in Thursday's PI, I am, as of Tuesday, no longer doing anything for Seattle Weekly. I basically walked out of there and told them where they could stuff their alternative weekly. And I'm certainly not the first to do so in recent months. You know, we had talked on this show when the acquisition of Seattle Weekly and its parent company, Village Voice Media, by New Times at the end of last year went through, that there could be a real danger that that the paper would be gutted, that it would be remade in New Times imagery, and that the changes would not be positive in terms of the city of Seattle. And that is now happening. They took their time with it. I think they were planning to do it gradually over a long period of time, but when editor Knut Berger decided to resign last month, and he did so specifically because he didn't want to work with these people, and there were reasons for that, but he hasn't really said them publicly, so I won't either. That started a cascade of events, basically. And while I was out of town and missed a couple weeks here, the poop kind of hit the fan. Managing editor Chuck Taylor sat down with a meeting with executive associate editor of EVM, a guy named Andy Vanderwart out of Denver, and they came out of that meeting with Chuck's resignation in hand. Officially, it's a resignation. A lot of people inside the paper believe that it was not a voluntary thing. Chuck isn't saying one way or the other. Moments later, George Howland, the long-term political editor, who, aside from me, is probably the most progressive person in the newsroom there, also resigned. He's landed on his feet, by the way. He has a job at the city council through Nick Licata now, which is, you know, good for him and good for the council. George is a very good guy. So that was, you know, three major people whose last day was all this Wednesday. I didn't talk about it on the air last week, but I was in the middle of this because when I got back into town a week ago Thursday night, it was to step into a breakfast meeting on Friday morning with Mr. Vanderwart from VVM and the person that he had chosen to replace Chuck Taylor, who is Mike Seeley, a reporter who is originally from Seattle. 4 years ago, he got his first journalism job, which was going to a New Times paper in St. Louis. And when New Times bought VVM, he applied for a transfer, basically, because he wanted to come back to Seattle. Well, that went through about 4 months ago, and so Mike's been back here since then. And he, you know, he's a good guy. I like Mike. He's a good writer and reporter. He's sharp. I think in normal circumstances, he would, you know, there's a steep learning curve. He has relatively little journalism experience and zero management experience, but he'll learn. The problem is that in this case, well, two things. Number one is he's being told virtually everything to do with the paper. I'm sure that they pick a young, inexperienced guy to have in place very intentionally. And then second, he's been placed in an impossible situation because the paper is disintegrating / being dismantled before his eyes. And there's a lot of resentment about it, both within the paper itself and in the community at large. The departure of Skip and Chuck and George was kind of the culmination of a steady departure of long-time Seattle Weekly people over the last 6 months. People, you know, senior people, the art director, a number of people in advertising, people like Roger Downey, who has been with the paper since it was founded 30 years ago and has now basically pulled off of staff and is only going to occasionally contribute freelance, and I'm not even sure where that stands after all this. So anyway, I had my meeting last Friday with Mr. Vanderwart, and there were a number of things that were said that were disturbing to me, and so there was an editorial meeting on Monday, and I had another meeting with Mike after that, and there were some additional disturbing things that were said and done at both the meeting and in my conversation with Mike, because a couple things. Number one, it was made clear to me that I was not in their long-term plans at all. Number two, I was being told what topic to write about, what to write about it, and how to write about it, which is pretty unacceptable to me. I've had pretty remarkable editorial freedom there over the years. And what they wanted me to write and how they wanted me to write about it was very directly and not in my own personal interest. Specifically, they wanted me to be an attack dog and go after, you know, a political media figure here in town. And, you know, normally I would be somewhat willing to do that. I didn't entirely agree with the assessment, but mostly. But you can't really do that unless you have the backing of the publication. The publication is telling me at the same time that I'm not in their long-term plans. You know, it's kind of foolish to go after somebody who moves in political and media circles from whom I may either be working next to or asking for a job from in another month or two. So clearly it wasn't going to work. And, you know, I felt I was being lied to. I felt I was being disrespected after the number of years of advertising sales and people picking up the paper because of my presence there. And so I quit. You know, I think a lot of people are going to be unhappy about that. Not that I quit, but that the situation there is such that that I'm no longer going to participate with that paper. But I, you know, the larger issue is that it's not just me. It's me, it's Skip, it's Chuck, it's George, the remaining three news people there on staff, Philip Dowdy and Rick Anderson and Nina Shapiro, all of whom are also very experienced. And between the four of us who are left, you've got, you know, 80 or 90 years worth of political and media experience in the city. You don't replace that easily. None of them, I think, are particularly happy with how events have transpired. They're basically dismantling the news department, and they're not going to replace it with a news department. In fact, in the article in the PI on Thursday, there were a couple of priceless quotes from Mike, who is just inexperienced enough that he, you know, blurts out the truth to a newspaper reporter, even though, you know, you really shouldn't be saying these things to the public. You know, my favorite quotes in the article is that the paper is going to, quote, shift towards storytelling rather than giving people the facts. And, quote, I don't want to feel obligated to cover anything. And that pretty much tells you where they want to go with it. They want to turn it basically into a city magazine. They want to tell cute stories about entertaining people and, you know, not really have a news department. There will be some investigative pieces. Probably some of them will be fairly good. They will not have any interest in local politics. They're not going to do any endorsements. They're going to have very little connection to local politics. And they're certainly not going to be open to, you know, to activism and grassroots community politics the way the Weekly has been in the past. And I think it's a real loss for the community. So that's what's going on at the Weekly. And in the meantime, I need a job. So if anybody knows of anything out there available, listen for the ETS phone number at the end of the show and call it.
And something that doesn't involve heavy lifting.
Preferably, yes. Or, you know, cleaning outhouses or things like that.
All right. Well, moving along, sticking with local news, Lieutenant Aaron Watata had a hearing on Thursday.
Yes, he did, and it was, from all accounts, I was not there, but a pretty amazing event. Among other people, Francis Boyle, who's the longtime international law professor from the University of Illinois, who's written extensively on civil disobedience and, you know, the right to, you know, refuse cooperation with illegal government orders, basically. He testified. Ann Wright, who's the former U.S. diplomat who was in charge of the U.S., I don't know if it was an embassy at the time or a mission or what it was at, in Afghanistan. And then Dennis Holliday, the former U.N. figure who was involved with the Iraq Oil for Food program. And they all spoke very eloquently about the situation in Iraq at the time of the U.S. invasion, that the U.S. invasion was basically done on a pretext of lies, that, you know, the Congress was given inaccurate information at the time the war was authorized. And not only inaccurate information, but information that was intentionally deceptive. And, you know, what they're trying to do legally is make the case that the war itself is illegal and that, therefore, Lieutenant Watada is legally justified in refusing orders to deploy there. Now, this, mind you, is in an army court, so I think probably the chances of his winning are not very high. You don't have a long history in military courts of people successfully arguing that a war is illegal. But it's real significant that, number one, these arguments are being made and being made by very credible people, and number two, that you're getting extensive media coverage of this. So it's really quite a remarkable case, and we've got it, you know, going on pretty close to home here in Fort Lewis. It's a nationally very significant case, just as last week the announcement of Sergeant Ricky Clausing that he was turning himself in after having basically deserted after a tour in Iraq where he worked as an interrogations officer in an infantry division. He turned himself in at the Vets for Peace conference here. He announced it last week, and then he turned himself in the following day at Fort Lewis a week ago yesterday. So that case is also going to be unfolding. I think he was transferred back to Fort Bragg for disciplinary measures there, but we want to keep an eye on that case as well.
All right. Jump into national. Big news this week when a judge ordered that warrantless wiretaps were unconstitutional.
Yeah, Judge Anna Riggs Taylor, elderly African-American judge in Detroit, basically handed the Bush administration their head on a platter. The Bush folks didn't lose everything. In fact, one of the things that was not emphasized in the coverage was that Judge Taylor upheld the argument that the State Secrets Act covered the ability of the Bush administration to not divulge details of the data mining program that the NSA has been doing on domestic telephone calls. But the warrantless spying episode, the one originally reported by the New York Times last December and that they sat on since prior to the November 2004 election, is not covered by the State Secrets Act, Judge Taylor ruled. Judge Taylor also ruled that not only was it not covered by the State Secrets Act, it was also not covered, as the Justice Department had argued, by the authorization of the use of military force, which is the congressional authorization for the war in Iraq. She threw all that out. She ruled that the warrantless spying program was an egregious violation of the Fourth Amendment, also a violent violation of the First Amendment, therefore unconstitutional, that it also violated the FISA Act of 1978, that it also violated separation of powers. And she used very, very strong language in saying all this. Now, of course, the Justice Department immediately appealed this. This is almost certainly going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, where Republican appointed justices hold a majority, and it's been obviously pretty heavily politicized along those lines in the past. So this may or may not stand in the long term, and probably by the time it gets to the Supreme Court, we're going to be very close to the 2008 election. But this initial ruling, anyway, is a very, very strong setback for the Bush administration, and particularly because this is the first time that a judicial ruling that almost exclusively looks at the Bush administration's argument of the unitary executive theory, that essentially that Bush is above the law. We saw that a little bit with the Guantanamo Bay ruling that the military tribunals were illegal, that Bush couldn't carry that out. But this is a case where Bush has said specifically that he can ignore the FISA law whenever he wants because it's a matter of national security, and that trumps everything for the commander-in-chief. And that has been thrown out completely by this federal court. It's a really quite a sharp setback for Bush, and it also is a real reinforcement of the argument that Bush is proud carrying out of this program repeatedly over a period of a number of years, and proud advocacy for it is an impeachable offense, that he has knowingly violated the law. So we'll see where this goes.
All right. Well, speaking of thrown out completely, there are some people down in New Orleans that look like they have their insurance coverage thrown out completely.
Yeah, this actually, the ruling was in Mississippi, but it covers Katrina victims in both Mississippi and Louisiana. Of course, the anniversary of Katrina is coming up on August 29th in a little over a week, so we're going to be hearing a lot more about Katrina in the days to come. But this is a particularly egregious ruling and a bad one. Another U.S. district judge, a guy named L.T. Sender Jr., ruled basically that hundreds and hundreds of households, probably affecting thousands of people, did not have insurance policies. The insurance industry had gone to court to fight this, claiming that they didn't need to pay damages because their policies did not cover, quote, wind-blown water damage, which, of course, is what damages things in a hurricane. So why get insurance on the Gulf Coast if you have an insurance policy that doesn't cover hurricane damage? Well, you know, insurance companies, very much like health insurance companies that don't really want to insure sick people, insurance companies would love to wriggle out of having to insure people in high-risk geographic areas because of natural disasters. That is what has happened here. So now you've got hundreds of households in Mississippi and Louisiana that are having, you know, had their homes badly damaged or destroyed that are not going to have any recourse to insurance policies that they thought would cover this. It's you know, once again, you know, more evidence that these victims simply aren't being taken care of. And what was more appalling is that this ruling was not widely publicized. The place where it got the most attention was in the business pages of various newspapers, and it was presented in the heading of, you know, great news for the insurance industry, and stocks are up, you know, which again is demonstrates the complete disconnect between what's good for global capitalism and what's good for actual, you know, people. So there you go.
All right. How about an Abramoff update?
Yeah, Robert Nye, the embattled congressman from Ohio who has all but been indicted, his chief of staff has already pled guilty in the Abramoff scandal, withdrew from his reelection race in Ohio this week, which is the first time, unless you count Tom DeLay, who had some other legal problems as well, the first time that a congressman has been taken down by the Abramoff scandal, and he probably won't be the last.
All right. And Arlen Specter and Charles Grassley are...
Yes, Republican senators. Specter heads the Justice Committee. Grassley heads the Finance Committee. And they have sent a very strongly worded and nasty letter to the Securities and Exchange Commission. Why? What is wrong with the FCC in the eyes of Republicans? Well, apparently, Republicans are in the Senate are distancing themselves from the Bush administration as fast as they can. The SEC's problem in this case is that they failed to adequately investigate a financial scandal involving the Pequot Capital Management, which PCM is a hedge fund on Wall Street. And it turns out the major reason the SEC treated PCM with kid gloves is that several high-level executives that were involved in this particular scandal were also heavily involved in the George W. Bush reelection fundraising efforts. In other words, it was a politically motivated, you know, hands-off kind of decision, and politically motivated in the sense that people who apparently violated the law pretty egregiously were closely connected to the Bush administration, and therefore they didn't get seriously investigated. And the ranking Republican senators are upset about this, which tells you just how egregious it must have been.
All right. And finally, nationally, the Interior Department has some plans for Alaska.
Yeah, you may remember last week when the Prudhoe Bay pipelines were shut down by BP because they were leaking all over the North Slope tundra. Well, the Interior Department, only a week later, in a finally timed sense of irony, has asked to open a vast area of environmentally sensitive wetlands in a place called Lake Teshikpuk, and I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, on the north slope of Alaska, very close to Prudhoe Bay. It's the same oil field, basically. They want to open it to new oil drillings, even though opponents are pointing toward corroding pipelines to the east in Prudhoe Bay as a reason to keep the area off off limits, which it currently has been. So the Bush administration, as with Anwar, is just pushing right ahead to try and try and open new areas to oil drilling there, even though we're in the midst of an environmental scandal where the corroding pipelines have been leaking oil into the tundra for years and years and years, and it's finally come to the public's attention.
All right, jump into international Lebanon.
Yeah, we have a tenuous ceasefire in place. Our fantasy president is claiming that Israel won the war. Funny thing that nobody in the Middle East thinks Israel won the war, including everyone in Israel and the Israeli government, including all the Arab governments, certainly including Hezbollah. Turns out that the Israeli military never did manage to get very far into Lebanon. They certainly didn't get the 18-mile barrier that they wanted to get. And they certainly didn't disempower Hezbollah. Hezbollah is pretty much intact. Hezbollah is certainly not in the process of nor planning to disarm, as the UN Security Council has demanded. But then again, they're defying UN order, and as the Lebanese government defied the UN Security Council order a couple of years ago to disarm Hezbollah themselves, in their case they really couldn't because Hezbollah was stronger than the Lebanese army. But this is done in the context of Israel's having repeatedly violated the Lebanese border over the last 6 years since its withdrawal, both those violations and its original occupation of Lebanon for 18 years between 1982 and 2000 were violations of UN Security Council resolutions. So is the Israeli occupation of the nearby Golan Heights, which is part of the Syrian involvement of in this whole mess and its support for Hezbollah. So of course are all the Israeli resolutions having to do with occupation of the military the occupied territories in Palestine over the years. So we're getting a lot of coverage of Hezbollah and Lebanon refusing to obey UN Security Council resolutions. They ain't the only ones. Israel has got a long, long track record of doing exactly the same thing. We have President Fantasyland here in Washington thinking the exact opposite happened than actually happened, which should remind you of another Middle East country where he's been making those pronouncements for the last 3 years. Israel also legally extended the kidnapping of the Palestinian Authority speaker, a Hamas member named Abd al-Aziz Duik. We have, as of the ceasefire, reports that up to 30,000 Lebanese homes have been destroyed by Israeli bombing. That according to a UN aid official. Of course, that doesn't include, apartment buildings. It doesn't include commercial buildings. It certainly doesn't include all the infrastructure that was bombed. Oddly enough, it's Hezbollah primarily that has launched into reconstruction of the area. Now, the Bush administration is saying, well, we recognize that Hezbollah is going to get a lot of credibility with the Lebanese for doing all of this reconstruction, so we want to get right in there and do some reconstruction also. To compete with Hezbollah? Well, they don't have people on the ground there the way that Hezbollah does. They certainly don't have any credibility having, obstructed a ceasefire for nearly a month and allowed Israel to do all this destruction. But they've set aside some money for it. How much have they set aside? $50 million. Now, this is 1/400th of the amount of money that the U.S. set aside for reconstruction in Iraq, and we know how effective that was. So don't hold your breath on this one, but that's probably another $50 million down the drain for the fiscally conservative Republicans. Last but not least... just a thought. The U.S. wants to compete with the reconstruction because it doesn't want to come out of all this with a bad image in the Middle East. Well, maybe they should have thought of that before they invaded Iraq. Maybe they should have thought of that before siding with Israel, not just in this war, but for the last 40 years. The damage is pretty complete at this point.
All right, Iraq.
Still going to heck in a handbasket. As of September August 11th, excuse me, the U.S. military unveiled a strategy to build walls between neighborhoods in Baghdad to try and keep the sectarian violence down, to keep adjacent neighborhoods that are, you know, Sunni or Shiite from attacking and killing each other. Well, this is very reminiscent of another area where another imperial power has built a massive wall in the Middle East, that, of course, in Israel. And so that's going to go over great with the Israelis. They're first doing that in the Dora neighborhood of Baghdad, where there's been a lot of bloodshed, but it's really not clear what that's going to accomplish, particularly because there was also a very interesting report in Tuesday's Washington Post that sectarian civil war isn't just in Baghdad anymore. That's spreading out to the communities in Diyala province, which is to the north and east of Baghdad in particular, but also a number of other areas in central Iraq where, again, you've got Sunni and Shiite villages attacking each other with mortar fire with militias. You've got death squads going out. So it's not just in Baghdad that we're seeing the disintegration in a civil war. And the U.S. military seems pretty helpless to do anything about it.
All right. And then moving over to Afghanistan.
Yeah. Some stuff we didn't get to last week. We have a fresh scandal in Afghanistan where on the 29th of May in a place called Khair Khana, a district of North Kabul, you have photographs that have now been released, 20 of them that appear to show a group of up to four unarmed Afghan civilians being killed by gunfire from an American Humvee. This, of course, being yet another PR coup for the occupying forces. By the way, that report was in British media, not U.S. media. You also have a report this week that opium production in Afghanistan is up 40% to its highest levels in recorded history. And you will recall, of course, that when we came in 2001 and displaced the Taliban, we did it primarily through the CIA and through using a proxy army, the Northern Alliance, which was primarily composed, that's it, of old warlords who had been heavily into poppy and opium production in the old days prior to the Taliban, as well as being involved in a lot of war crimes. So it's like, are between the CIA and the warlords, are we really surprised that opium production and poppy production in Afghanistan is a booming business? And that's the spread of democracy in Afghanistan for this week.
All right. Talking, as we do every week, with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Well, it's Eat the State's still paying me what it's always paid me, which is zero. It's a volunteer publication that we've been putting out for 10 years now. Our 10th anniversary is next month. And you can find it free of charge in places where you find free periodicals, bookstores, cafes, the King County Library System, et cetera, et cetera. The coming issue that's coming out this week will have our election endorsements for the September 19th primary. We're starting to do it a little bit earlier since so many people are using absentee ballots, and next year we'll all be ballot by mail. So, and we'll start talking about that in another week or two here on the program also, what's on the ballot and what I think we should do. So it's available there. It's also available on the web, as the election stuff also will be, at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, personal job leads, you can give our voicemail a call. It's area code 206-719-6947.